This is Clinical Conversations. Last time we looked into what's causing the rise in mumps outbreaks in the U.S. This time it's pertussis, or whooping cough, that's having an unwelcome resurgence, and our guest thinks he knows why. Dr. Pejman Rahani and his co-authors published a study in Science Translational Medicine last week. They used 16 years of what they call highly resolved incidence data from Massachusetts to test their hypotheses. Dr. Rahani is a professor at the Odum School of Ecology, as well as in the Department of Infectious Disease and the Center for Ecology of Infectious Diseases, all at the University of Georgia in Athens. Welcome to Clinical Conversations.
Thank you.
You've recently written about the pertussis enigma in a review article at the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Do you think you've partially solved the enigma?
Let me maybe back up and say why I think pertussis is an enigma.
Okay.
Because the answer is kind of, the answer to your question about solving the enigma is probably a partial yes.
Okay.
Pertussis is an enigma because there are experiences patterned in the contemporary epidemiology of the bacterium that are very different across different countries. So in some countries where vaccine uptake is high, we're seeing resurgence. In some countries where vaccine uptake is high, we're not seeing resurgence. Countries that use the same vaccine are experiencing, some are experiencing the resurgence, some are not experiencing the resurgence. So there is a certain inconsistency in what's happening in different countries. So that's what makes pertussis enigmatic. In the U.S., which is probably the most high profile of these countries where resurgence has been observed, somewhat informally, the new generation of vaccines, the so-called acellular vaccines, have been held accountable, or at least suspected of underlying the resurgence. And so our approach was really to try and do a careful bookkeeping of who's born, did they get the vaccine, and then did they subsequently get infected, and using that kind of accounting system almost, which is what a mathematical model allows you to do, we were able to test different hypotheses about how does the vaccine work, what's the nature of vaccine-derived protection, how long does it last, and how effective is it? So in the context of the U.S., it would be a partial yes to the enigma.
Your group examined three possible vaccine failures that could serve as paths to pertussis reemergence. One was the failure of the vaccine to take in some recipients. Another was the waning of the vaccine's protection over time. And the third was changes in the antigenic makeup of the pertussis bacterium, so-called leakiness of the vaccine. So how'd you go about investigating the possibilities?
So we can specify, we can construct a model, a mathematical model, which is our, it's a caricature of how transmission happens in a population. And in that setting, the model will make predictions about maybe the patterns in the oscillations of pertussis incidence. Do we get yearly outbreaks? Do we get 4-yearly outbreaks? That kind of thing. And additionally, our model has age stratification. So we can put in infants, you know, and they get vaccinated at age 2 months and 4 months and 6 months. So we put the vaccine schedule. And so we can then contrast what the model predicts, both in terms of the overall epidemiology of pertussis, but also predictions about patterns in specific age groups. And then we can contrast that in a statistical sense with data. And that allows us to figure out which of the hypotheses that you mentioned has the most support in a formal statistical sense from the data that we have.
And you looked at data from Massachusetts from 1990 to 2005 inclusive, so that's 16 years of data. And why did you use, there was an interesting reason that you chose that slice of time. Can you say why?
So we chose Massachusetts because they have an active surveillance program, and it's in some ways considered the gold standard in the U.S., and we chose that time period because in 2006, two things happened. One of them was the rollout of the so-called TDAP, booster for 11 and older individuals, and also a switch to serology in case ascertainment for adults in Massachusetts. So the nature of the data changed in two ways in from 2006 onwards. And so we didn't want to, when you're trying to understand one thing, it's difficult. When you're trying to understand three things, it makes it even harder. So we wanted to pin down the efficacy of the so-called DTaP vaccine, the vaccine that's given in the primary schedule, before moving on to consider in a future study what the Tdap, what the effects of the Tdap vaccine are on circulation of the bacteria.
Okay. You found a resurgence, and you found a resurgence not so much among young, among infants who were being vaccinated generally according to the schedule, but among people above the age of 20. The reason the alarms go off when you have even a slight resurgence among among infants rather, is that in infants the disease is much more serious and more likely to be fatal than among older people.
Okay.
So when you ran your transmission models against the actual data from the outbreaks, what did you see?
So our model predicts that the DTaP vaccine is, the failure that's associated with the DTaP vaccine is in fact associated with waning immunity and not, there is some primary vaccine failure, and we found no evidence for the so-called leakiness, which would be something like, as you mentioned, antigenic mismatch between the vaccine and the circulating bacteria. However, the waning that we estimate from the data suggests that the vaccine is protective for a much longer period of time than is currently thought by clinical epidemiologists. So we estimate that on average, the vaccine is protective for many decades. However, the important thing to point out is that we also find the vaccine immunity is quite variable among individuals. So some individuals lose immunity reasonably quickly within 10 years of getting the last dose, and some individuals may never lose immunity. So that variation among individuals is an important feature of the data.
One of the things that you discussed was that its resurgence in older adults, and you posit a model in which the older people who were exposed naturally to pertussis and therefore had acquired pretty much a lifelong immunity, they're dying out. And when the vaccines became available at the in the late 1940s, I think its uptake among the population was imperfect. And so I think your paper describes that as the end of the Cinderella effect. So the people who survived the pertussis unvaccinated are now older and in their 70s and 80s and dying out. And the newer people are less likely to have been vaccinated than the newest cohorts. Do you think that explains the resurgence in among older people, among baby boomers, for instance?
We may put your question another way, which is, if we know that historically 100% of newborns were not vaccinated in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, vaccine uptake was not as high as it is today. And when we include something like that in our models, we see resurgence of pertussis, especially among older individuals, as a natural prediction from the model. So another way of putting the same thing is to say, how much of this resurgence actually requires explanation?
Yes.
Right? It seems to be an inevitable outcome of incomplete vaccination with an imperfect vaccine.
So the earlier vaccines were imperfect.
The earlier and the current vaccines, right? So the vaccines are efficacious, but they're not 100% efficacious, right? That would be a perfect vaccine.
So what you did, you made what you called retrodictions as opposed to predictions.
Right.
And so you look back on historic data, even earlier than that 16-year period, and you said, do the models that we propose, do they explain what we see in the earlier data? Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
So we found that very similar to what we know about historical patterns of pertussis incidence in Massachusetts, that there was a gradual decline in incidence in the 50s and 60s with a minimum in incidence in the mid-1970s. And since the 1970s, in our model, as in the data, there's been a gradual increase in pertussis incidence, leading to reasonably large outbreaks in the last few years. So that was the historical data of Massachusetts was not something that we fitted the model to. And so this was a sanity check. That if we use the model to explain historical data, we got a good agreement with observed patterns.
So that gives you confidence in the model that you've put forward.
Exactly.
Now, your results have got real implications for setting vaccination policy. And one of the things that you mentioned in the paper is the fact that we would be better off as a in the U.S., to focus more on younger groups, even though people my age, we're showing an increase in the infection rate here. So why do you say that we'd be better off focusing on younger people on the say, you know, between ages 10 and 20?
So it's probably more like between the ages of 5 and 20.
Okay.
And the primary reason for that is that those age groups have many more contacts during the day, contacts with other people during the day than we as grown-ups do. And so making sure that those what we call core transmission groups, the groups that are really responsible for amplifying transmission in a population, if they're protected, you actually get a lot more bang for your buck than targeting older individuals who are responsible for proportionately less of the transmission. This is related to these ideas that have been going around for the last few years on cocooning, which has been a strategy of vaccinating parents and grandparents and uncles of newborns with the intention of cutting down the risk of transmission to newborns. And cocooning has been a strategy that's had mixed success. Mm-hmm. And part of the explanation is the CDC did a study a couple of years ago and identified that by looking at household surveys, that most of the transmission to infants was coming from their older siblings, not from their parents and grandparents. Right, so that's consistent with our conclusion that targeting children is going to be a more efficacious, more efficient way of controlling transmission than targeting older individuals.
So what do you hope that clinicians will take away from your work, Dr. Rahani?
I think the most important aspect of this work is that these acellular pertussis vaccines have really got bad rap recently. And part of this, as we show in our study, is a misinterpretation of cohort study data, which have been interpreted as saying these vaccines are waning very quickly. And we show that a more consistent explanation with the data is that it's really because kids are going to school after the fifth dose at age 4, and the increase in incidence is probably due to higher contact rates. So I would say the most significant conclusion is that these vaccines are actually much better than are currently thought.
I was just checking the footnotes to see I just wanted to see where your support came from. You don't have any from the acellular people, anyways.
This work is not funded by any pharmaceutical companies, but this is our support comes from the National Institutes of Health.
Okay. I want to thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Rahani.
Thank you.
That was our 221st edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org, where you can leave comments on this conversation. Or you can contact me on email, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. Kristen Kelly is the executive producer here for the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.